Dennis, reading from Peter's sermon at Pentecost, it's clear, isn't it, that there he's using parts of Psalm 16 to speak about the resurrection of Jesus. It's interesting, as we come to Psalm 16, it's right that we have that big perspective. There were some people who see David in this psalm as prophesying the resurrection of Jesus. So somebody's written, David was speaking as a prophet, having foreseen the resurrection of Christ. And clearly that's in the mind of the translators of the NIV. If you've noticed, in verse 10, they put capitals in "your Holy One." When we come to the New Testament, we can see that Peter, and later on in Acts, Paul, used this psalm to explain what God has done in the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus, whom God did not leave in the grave or Sheol long enough for the body to start to decay. Peter does this at Pentecost in Acts 2. Paul does it later on in Acts 13, where he's recorded in the synagogue at Pisidian Antioch. The early church used the psalm in the same way to interpret Jesus' resurrection and what God was doing in that resurrection. But I've got a question. Is it fair enough to say that Psalm 16 is just a prophecy of Jesus' resurrection? See, whenever we come to the psalm, any of the psalms, any of the Old Testament, and we see only prophesying about Jesus, we end up missing what God has to say to us completely. So there's certainly a connection with Psalm 16 and the resurrection of Jesus. But I think this morning we can actually unpack a great deal from the psalm. We can learn, in fact, about pressure that comes on our trust, pressure that affects our relationship with God, pressures that, in fact, we share today with David, even when he lived now 3,000 years ago. So the psalm's vital to our lives, to our understanding, to the big picture of what God's done. So as we look at Psalm 16, the thing we can see first and foremost is that it's really all about trust. Trust in God, or Yahweh, to give God his Old Testament name. There's very good reason to think that David was the one who wrote this psalm. So the psalm writer from here on, I will call David. As our January summer series featured the psalms each week, it might be helpful for me to remind you of two things at least about the psalms. The first is that all the psalms are sung poems. All of them. So in 2 Samuel 23 verse 1, David is called Israel's singer of songs. The second thing as we come to the psalms is that while we rightly think about the Bible as God speaking to us, the psalms are frequently God's people speaking to him. So keep in mind that the psalms are earth to heaven communication, and they're also David speaking to his people then, that he were hoping would sing his poems, and to us as well. Well, let's look at the psalm. Verse 1 begins with a plea, a prayer for protection. And as one scholar wants to translate it, "Keep me safe, O God. Keep on protecting me as in the past." But interestingly, it's the only plea in the psalm. The psalm is really David thinking, writing, singing about the place of his trust in his relationship with God. And that relationship with God, that trust, grows out of his testimony. There in verse 1, "For in you I take refuge," or "because I rely on you." And in verse 2, you, Yahweh, you God, are not just Lord, you are my Lord. "For in you I take refuge" is an expression that's used in the Psalms for trusting one's life to God's care. So here we have David. David, a person who has trusted himself to Yahweh. After David's plea for safety, verses 1 to 6 are about where David's trust fits in his faith and his commitment to the Lord. He goes on in verses 7 to 11 to see where trust fits in his future hope. So here we see David looking both to the present and to the future. And as David looks to the present and to the future, he sees that trust in Yahweh faces two powerful pressures. The first pressure, he realises, comes from people. Which people and who these people are is not absolutely certain. Whoever they are, their end is certain, and it's an end that's not protected. In verse 4, they are people whose sorrows will increase. Some think that they are followers or devotees of other gods, but because the words the saints and the glorious ones that we have there in verse 3 don't have this meaning anywhere else in Scripture, it's possible that David is speaking to urge people around him who want to be committed to Yahweh not to follow those who have already turned to other gods. So David's urging people not to join them, to stay faithful to their commitment to Yahweh. He says that because there's real pressure on trust. There's pressure to become unfaithful, disloyal to the one true God. There's pressure to think, as these people did, that their security, materially and spiritually, lay in their own effort and provision as much as their commitment to Yahweh. It's very possible that there were those in David's world who liked an each-way bet. The man or woman who could mouth a proper thing to say to the Lord, "You are my Lord," the appropriate words to say to God, "You are my master," but whose commitment was in fact elastic. People stretch their commitment so that just as easily as they can have Yahweh, they could also be a devotee of other gods, believing in that they had all the bases covered, that theirs was a winning bet. People who have a bet each way in David's day are not really so different to us, are they? There is pressure on our trust whenever we go down the God plus track. When we're in a tight spot, it's easy to look to God, to look to him alone. But have you noticed that when things become brighter, our commitment to the Lord becomes duller, even dark? We so readily turn to seeking our safety in God, yes? But we sometimes look for extra security in counterfeit gods. We can be God plus people just as much as the people to whom David was speaking. Now, as a preacher, I can rattle off the usual example of the pluses, how we want people to think of us, our achievements personally or for family or community, our career, our clever financial planning and sound investments. It's easy to create a list of the pluses, but that's to create a danger for you. You see, I can create a list and you can sit there and you think, "Oh yes, I know, she does that, he does that, yes, yes, yes." And you can get to the end of the list and guess what? It doesn't apply to you. What we need to do, you and I, without exception, is to kneel before the Lord and to ask him to put his finger on who or what we worship, as well as or even instead of him. So here's a take-home challenge for you. But when you think about it, maybe one that you'll probably prefer to leave here rather than take it home. But perhaps in the course of this week, as we revisit the psalm, you might pray for me, as I will pray for you, that we will kneel in front of the living God and ask him to put his finger on just what we are and what we believe. Well, notice in verse 4, in the second part of the verse, that David won't participate with those who are chasing after other gods, counterfeit gods, the God plus people. He won't even speak the names of false gods. David will not serve two masters. David, in fact, practices the first commandment in his life. And he wants to urge a commitment to Yahweh which contrasts with that of the people who have turned to other gods. And so as we look at the psalm, we can see there's a deepening trust in David's relationship with God, from reliance on Yahweh in verse 1 to worshipping Yahweh in verse 7 to joy and gladness in verse 9. And in verse 7, David breaks into thanksgiving. Thanksgiving that the Lord has given him counsel, that at night his heart instructs him. It's interesting to notice how guidance comes. It comes from within the psalmist, because Yahweh's teaching is written into the heart, as we learn from Deuteronomy 30:14. No, the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so that you may obey it. Now, as an aside, for those who are interested in the Bible and anatomy, you might need to know that when the Bible uses the word heart, the Hebrew is kidneys. So the way the heart, or the kidneys, instructs is the important thing. It's causing the person to put Yahweh in front of their eyes all the time. There's a good word from Calvin. Well, there are probably a few good words from Calvin, but he said this about the Psalms. To set God before us is nothing else than to keep all our senses bound and captive, that they may not run out and go astray after any other object. Because of the centrality of his relationship with God in his life, David knows that Yahweh is at his right hand, and the right hand is the position of support. Yahweh's being there is David's basis for his joyful confidence for the future. Notice in verse 9 what's really significant, that David's confidence for the future includes the whole person. Heart, soul, flesh refer to parts of the person, but together they stand for the whole person. And the me in verse 10 has, in the sense of the Hebrew word, a person also as a whole, the whole self. Here's another reminder that there is no Greek body, soul, two-part person in Scripture. We are a whole. The second, and perhaps for everyone, including David, the second trust now appears. The pressure, rather, appears on his trust. And that second pressure is destruction of the whole person. Trust brings confidence, we can see from verses 9 to 11. Trust brings confidence in the face of death. And David expresses his confidence that a person committed to the Lord will not be abandoned to death. So here's an insight, or more than that, here's a clear biblical teaching about death. Death, in the thinking and teaching of the Psalms, is not only the opposite of life, the loss of one's whole existence, all that one is, because there is no soul continuing separately from the body at death. The Greeks thought that, the Scriptures know nothing of it. Not only is it the loss of our total person, it is God who is lost in death. God keeping us on the path of life means that we receive far more than a continuing existence. David tells us that we receive the joys and pleasures of the presence of God, because life and joy go together. So, having taken refuge in God, in verse 1, David found him his greatest good, as he says in verses 2 and 6 and 7. So ultimately being convinced that even death can't rob him of true life. So the Psalm's declaring that there's a life-giving connection between our relationship with God and our lives here and now. The Psalm teaches us that we need to treasure a relationship with God, out of which flow the gifts of life, and that the ultimate protection of that life never ends in death and destruction. So, the poem to be sung that David wrote was not a prophecy about Jesus' resurrection, but a poem about the conquest of death and the fullness of life and joy in the presence of God. There are pressures on trust for us to take serious note of. And for us, like David, we can see and know the pressure of a God plus other gods, or a false gods, lifestyle. And we can see it in the people all around us. There's huge pressure to join them in doubting God, of being disloyal. Like David, we can see the pressure on trust that death brings. But unlike David, we aren't just confidently trusting God about not abandoning us to the grave, about leaving us to decay. Unlike David, we have the proof that God has the power to do it. He has done it for Jesus, and he will do it for us who are committed to him. In the resurrection of Jesus, the Lord has truly made known the path of life. Remember Jesus' words to his good friends, Martha and Mary, on the death of their brother Lazarus. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will never die. So, the apostolic church, the early church, read Psalm 16 in the light of the resurrection of Jesus, as we have seen in Acts 2 with Peter at Pentecost, and as we can go on and read Paul in the city in Antioch synagogue. They were all right to see verse 10 as the hope. As the hope fulfilled for the first time when Jesus was raised from the dead by his Father. So this morning, what do we need to do? We need to take home all that David has told us about the pressures on trust. And we need to take home what Peter and Paul saw as the proof in Jesus' resurrection. For trusting God's promise of joy in his presence and eternal pleasures at his right hand. In your bulletin, you would have received an outline that you might care to take home with you as you revisit the psalm this week. My hope is that we all might find time to spend thinking and praying over the psalm and going on to read the absolute wonderful proof and assurance that's there in Peter's sermon.